don't need no education.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. Your host is the headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy, Rebecca Hagstrom, along with co-host Mark Durkin. School is now in session.
Good morning. This is Rebecca Hagstrom with Education Nation, and I'm here with my co-host, Mark Durkin.
Another good morning to you, Rebecca.
Yes, and we are excited to join our listeners again for an exciting edition of Education Nation. And last week, we talked to introduce to you, our listeners, something called the Blaine Amendment that had a very sordid past. Brought about through, unfortunately, very bigoted tendencies by our early, forefathers of the United States. Back in that time, in the 1800s, the Protestants were dominating the public schools at the time, and the Blaine Amendments came around in their attempt to try to keep the Catholics from receiving any of the public money for schooling. And out of that attempt at the federal level came about 29 states that adopted similar Blaine Amendments across the country.
Yes.
And so we introduced all of that. If you're interested in learning more, it's a very interesting show just to find out the past about these Blaine Amendments, because now they are very, very important in the topic of school choice in today's world. And so we're going to continue our conversation really from where we left off last week.
Yes. And once these Blaine Amendments came into play in the 1800s, we then turned at the century of the 20th century into the early 1900s. And with generic Protestant education structures in America's public schools in place during that time, students were thriving. In fact, pre-1840, literacy rates were high. Schools predominantly were privately and locally controlled, and homeschooling was common as well. But then we began to see a subtle shift a little bit in the middle of the 19th century. In 1852, Massachusetts passed the first mandatory attendance law.
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? To think that it wasn't mandatory, because again,
right.
You know, we're over 100 years later now from when these Blaine Amendments passed, and it's kind of hard for us to comprehend that there was a day when that type of bigotry existed between two religious groups that were both Christian,
right.
And that there was not mandatory attendance, because, boy, we've had that around for a long time. We never would have imagined there was a day when that wasn't mandatory.
Right.
But the nation's history of education is very interesting. There was a time when many people were homeschooled, and
right.
We had the one-room schoolhouses where multiple
were
grades
well
were together, and they were. I mean, some kids were, you know, well, I would say the vast majority of kids that were in 7th and 8th grade were much better educated than our probably current adults in a lot of cases, sadly. Yeah, education was very different then, and the kids did not have extended childhoods like they do now.
That's right. Well, the federalization of American education really took off, as I mentioned, at the turn of the 20th century. John D. Rockefeller founded the General Education Board. Now, this provided major funding for public schools across the country, and it was active in promoting the state-controlled public school movement. In fact, the General Election Board was not interested, get this now, in encouraging critical thinking.
Can you believe that? You know, there's a lot of people who've done more research on education than I have, and I've done a fair amount myself, and it is very interesting that we just kind of take for granted our schools as being, you know, out to bring about the best outcome. And I think that the vast majority of people that are involved in public education, that is their goal. But it's interesting to note that even way back in looking at the establishment of the public schools and as they were transitioning from being Protestant dominated into more secularized, sadly, there were some not so altruistic purposes
right.
behind how they were developing the new educational system.
And on that note right there, a former teacher who was an award winner, his name was John Gatto, he said this was a quote from him, quote, School was looked upon from the first part of the 20th century as a branch of industry and a tool of governance. So in other words, its focus was on organizing children in creating reliable, predictable, obedient citizens. And Rockefeller, one of the quotes that he was also famously well known for is, "I don't want a nation of thinkers. I want a nation of workers."
Yeah. Again, not very altruistic, is it? Kind of shocking. And yet that is the type of education that was created. And it took a while for that type of educational system to get into our schools. A great read that I would recommend every listener read is Edie Hirsch, The Schools We Need and Why We Don't Have Them. And he talks a lot about how the schools have developed into what they are today, and that a lot of the changes in the philosophy of education occurred around the 1920s, between the 1880s and the 1920s. But once those changes in philosophy were occurring at the college level, it took a long time for that to infiltrate into or distilled down into the actual schools, because the schools were still filled with teachers and administrators. And according to Edie Hirsch, it was about the 1960s before the great turnover of teachers and administrators happened, where more of that process learning took place. And that is sadly, it's not going to create excellent critical thinkers. And so it's no accident to think that today, here we are in 2017, one of the biggest complaints that we hear from college professors and business leaders is that the students don't know how to think. I even have a board member who is a physician over at the University of Minnesota, and she does some teaching for their medical program there. And she said, even at the U of M Medical School, she's finding that the students coming in, they know how to research, they can look things up on the internet, but they do not know how to think critically. They don't know how to analyze and synthesize information. So sadly, Rockefeller, I don't know what he did to bring this about, but clearly he's an influential individual. And I think he, along with many others, did not necessarily want a very thinking electorate, just as he pointed out.
It was John Dewey, yes, as well, too.
Dewey, Horace Mann. Yes, these are all the people who brought us the progressive education system that does not bring about, but it does bring about, as Gatto said, reliable, predictable, obedient citizens. Mm-hmm. That's working. Mm-hmm. It's working. And kind of sad.
Well, throughout
kinda
the 20th...
Groupthink.
Right.
Groupthink rather than individualistic thinking.
Right. And I think many families across the country were really starting to catch on to this as it was beginning to take root in American society. So while those advancements were being made on the progressive secular side, major advancements were also being made towards, not only the state... controlled education for much of the 20th century, but also large strides of momentum being gained in the school choice movement as a response, especially over the last 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, 1990 was the first modern school choice program enacted in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in which they've been very successful with vouchers. And we made mention of that in the last program.
Yeah, we did. And at the end of that program. And the other thing of note is that Minnesota is home to the very first charter school legislation. The legislation was enacted in 1991, and it was a breakthrough legislation. It had not been done anywhere else in the country, and the first charter school was opened in Minnesota in 1992.
Mm-hmm. Well, and since then, there are now 58 programs in 28 states and Washington, D.C., that's now serving around 1.3 million students nationally.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Vouchers are one particular program that's growing. More states are considering issuing vouchers that may be used to pay private school tuition. And the prohibition against funding for religious schools will only, though, become increasingly debated as these vouchers continue to be successful, especially when funding prohibitions limit the ability of parents to decide what's best for their children.
Mm-hmm. And once again, I mentioned that last week as well, that every parent should have the right to decide how their child is educated. And if they want their child in a faith-based school, there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to do that.
That's right.
Yeah,
and
especially
parents,
with the First Amendment.
Yes, the free exercise thereof.
Yes, exactly.
Well, parents are choosing to leave public schools for school choice programs, so the question becomes, well, why are they doing that? Well, one, better academic quality. you know, mm-hmm. teaching kids how to think critically as opposed to how to test. And I'll let you go ahead and continue on that list.
Well, I think the number one reason. I think there's a lot of reasons, actually. I shouldn't say that's the number one. But I do think that even surveys have shown, we did a whole school choice show a while back,
yes.
and we had some data on there as to why parents would choose it. And most of them believe that private schools are better academically. And I'm sure that's not true in every single case, but I think by and large, as a generalization, that's probably true from an academic standpoint. Mm-hmm. And the critical thinking is actually happening in those schools.
Yes.
Another reason why parents would choose that is for safety. Oftentimes, a parent might feel that the public school that their child would attend or is near isn't necessarily physically safe for them, or maybe there's some bullying going on. Mm-hmm. And so if they can send them to a faith-based program where there's higher standards of behavioral discipline and expectations, that's a comfort for them. They know that their child is safe. And that's an important, again, parents should have the right to make these decisions for
Absolutely.
Their children. Yeah. Another reason we would see that type of choice on the part of a parent choosing a private school is that the environment itself is often different from that of a public school, especially because most private schools are smaller. And so you're going to have smaller class sizes. You're going to have, you know, lower teacher to student ratios, and you're going to have teachers who tend to then know their students better.
Yes.
And can just be there for them more, give them more extra help, more individualized instruction and individualized help. So that environment is really important. And if parents want to choose that, they should be able to do that. And tends to be a greater respect for authority in that type of an environment,
yes.
too, where the teachers know the kids so much better.
And this reminds me of our conversation that we had with Benito Matisse. He's the principal of Ascension Catholic
yes.
School. I mean, I believe there were about 750 students that he had within his private Catholic school.
Mm-hmm. And he is over in Northeast Minneapolis. And he said that school, Ascension, has been a legacy within that community for providing loving, kind support to the families and the students that are there. They actually refer to their children as scholars.
Yeah.
And that is just such a gift to give these kids. Again, that compared to the Minneapolis public schools where 50% of the students don't graduate from high school. Let's see. I wonder which school I would rather send my children to
right.
if I were a parent over in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Another issue that we see people wanting is the faith. So, you know, I named some of the academics and the safety and the different environment, the more respect. But some people just want faith to be taught. You know, morals are an important issue.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing the results of lack of morals across our culture today. So many more problems, and the problems are so much more significant than they were back in the 60s. We just had Grandparents' Day at Liberty, and I asked the grandparents, what were the biggest problems in school when you were growing up? And they said, chewing gum, running in the hallway, talking to your neighbor. You know, now we have much more severe things going on in our schools today. And I firmly believe that that's largely because the moral values are not being taught. We no longer have this agreed upon set of values that can be taught in the public schools. And so some people want that faith in, and why shouldn't they be able to do that?
Structure, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But the opposition to our school choice is fierce. So even though I know all those aforementioned reasons are great reasons for people to want school choice, so they can send their kids to the private school of their choice, there is a lot of opposition, and it's coming primarily, you might imagine, from the public school districts.
Yes.
Teachers' unions and those in favor of strict separation of church and state, even though we see what's happening. And
yes.
that's not. Again, I want to remind our listeners of our First Amendment. The free exercise clause is a very important thing for people to keep in mind. The separation of church and state does not mean you cannot have a free exercise of your religious faith.
That's exactly right. Well, we're going to take a short time out here on Education Nation. When we come back, we're going to allude and talk about those challenges against school choice by means of state Blaine amendments. You won't want to miss this. We'll be right back here on Education Nation.
We don't need no thought control.
And welcome back to Education Nation. I am your co-host, Mark Durkin, joined in studio, as always, with Rebecca Hagstrom. We are in week number two, talking about the controversial Blaine Amendments. Of course, there was an amendment that was in the process of trying to be passed at the end of the 19th century that failed at the federal level but was adopted at the state level of 29 states before the turn of the century that were aimed at cutting all public funds to all different types of sectarian organizations, which the code language back then was Catholic schools. And then as the state government began to take over the education process in the 20th century, it then began to extend in terms of public monies not being allocated to any religious schoolings. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, indeed. That's what we have today.
Yes. And of course, you know, with the parents recognizing this and wanting school choice for their children, there are now challenges that are coming against school choice legislation that is on the rise through the state Blaine Amendments.
Mm-hmm. Which is good, because the Federal Establishment Clause really does establish that we have the free exercise thereof. That's part of the Establishment Clause. So people, when they think of the First Amendment, they think, well, you know, Congress makes or has no right to establish a state religion. But it also says, or prevent the free exercise thereof. And that part often gets forgotten. So there are many who are trying to resurrect that part to receive public funds for the school of their choice. And since 2006, the Blaine Amendments have been used to challenge school choice programs 11 times, and they are being used to persuade state legislators and governors to reject school choice bills. But the good news is that supporters of school choice are becoming increasingly successful in defending against these challenges. And their primary argument that has been successful is that school choice scholarships do not result in giving public aid to religious schools.
This is important.
It is very important. Yes, listeners, pay attention. I feel like a teacher when I say that, right? Schools never receive aid as directly receiving something from another party, as it is understood. Instead, these schools receive payment in exchange for services. So in this case, parents pay these schools for the service of educating their child. So it's the families receiving the money, not the religious schools. And that is the reason why this argument has been successful. And it's convinced multiple courts that the Blaine Amendments do not apply to school choice programs. So this is good news.
You know, I just want to bring this up real quickly. I remember a conversation we had with Senator Roger Chamberlain a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
The Opportunity Scholarship Tax Credit that is being put together in conference committee before it goes to the governor's desk. Do you remember when he said that school choice advocates in the state, they want Jewish students to be able to go to Jewish schools, or Christian, you know, students to go to Christian schools, Muslim students, the same thing. You know, he very clearly said, look, this is not about the establishment of one religion. We want free educational choice for all families in Minnesota.
Right. The free exercise thereof. And so that's where it becomes so critical to note that difference, that it's not money being given to the schools, it's money being given to the families.
To make the choice.
So they can make the choice to send their children where they would like to go. And yeah, and you know, I'm going to just take that moment to actually turn our attention to the legislation that is before our legislature and the school choice legislation that passed through committee and hopefully will make it into the final bill that will go before the governor's desk involves tax credits. And this has been sponsored by the Opportunity Scholarship or Opportunity for All Children. So the OAK, O-A-K, is the group that helped draft all of this legislation and has helped usher it through. And the idea is that there would be private donations by an individual or a corporation to a qualified 501c3, so that means nonprofit, scholarship granting organization. And to say qualified means they have to meet certain specifications before they can even be awarded any of these funds to begin with. And one of the requirements I know is that they have to give to at least two different schools. They can't just set, so each individual school can't just set up their own granting organization and just try to funnel money into their own schools. So they've thought of that and they've protected against that. Not that that should be anything too bad, but I think it does make sense that these organizations be separate from schools. And that's one way to make sure that they're separate from schools. And so these qualified scholarship granting organizations, they can receive, those who donate to those organizations can receive up to a 70% tax credit on their Minnesota tax returns. That's a lot of money. So that's very a strong incentive, which I think will be very good, because how else are you going to fund these scholarship funds? So again, I want to emphasize with our listeners, this isn't even state money. This is the opportunity for people to donate into a fund and then receive a tax credit for their donation. So this is even more separated than what we were talking about earlier. Right.
I mean, the original argument is that as fellow taxpayers in the state of Minnesota, why can't we have choice over the say of where our monies go to in terms of our children's education? But here, you know,
this isn't
this,
even that.
It's you literally right. taking your own money and putting it where you want it to be.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's a great impetus for private school choice here. And so the individual maximum credit for donating into this fund is $10,500 for a $15,000 donation. And then for couples, it could go up to $21,000 for a $30,000 donation. And corporations, their max credit is $105,000 for a $150,000 donation. So again, it's a 70% tax credit. So you can receive 70% of your donation as a credit on your Minnesota tax returns. And then the other issue is that, or the other positive thing is that then the private school or the private scholarships that go to the students from this scholarship granting fund, they can give up to $7,500 to a student that it qualifies. So again, this is actually right now for low and middle income students. So up to an $89,000 income for a family of four can apply and receive these scholarships up to $7,500. Mm-hmm. That would be incredibly
absolutely
helpful,
fantastic.
Don't you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think about, again, like the students of Ascension, you know, we, like you said at our show last week, or was that earlier today, that we had Bonito from Ascension Catholic School, and so many of their children can't afford the tuition there. And I think he said they have to fundraise something like 75% or 80% of the tuition because they just have families that can't afford it.
Yes.
And so think of how helpful this would be for them, for their families that you know would qualify, most of their families, to be able to qualify for a $7,500 tax credit. Then they could take their time away from having to fundraise all the time and shift it to focusing even more on the students, which is where it belongs.
Yes.
And we know their results are good, and it's worth it. The other benefit of this legislation that hopefully will end up on the tax bill and hopefully signed by Governor Dayton is an expansion of the individual education tax credit. So the last thing that I spoke about is a tax credit for a donor, whether that be individual or corporate, into a scholarship fund. This is an expansion of the educational tax credit for individuals who are actually paying tuition. So if you have your child at a private school and you're paying tuition, they have extended that tax credit from what used to be just, well, number one, they've extended it to non-public tuition. It didn't used to include tuition. It used to only include things like lessons or materials and that kind of thing. And then the amount that you can extend it to is it went from $1,000 to $1,500. So you would now get a $1,500 tax credit instead of $1,000. And they've also increased the income eligibility. So it used to be at $37,000 was kind of the eligibility cap, and they've raised that now to $57,000. So that is a really big benefit that our listeners should take advantage of. They have their kids in private school. Hopefully that will pass.
Yes.
And end up as signed law. We don't know that yet, but that would be very, very helpful for a lot of families.
Lots of families.
Mm-hmm.
Big increases.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Well, for those of you who might be interested in making sure that this legislation makes it through and you want to email Governor Dayton, he needs to hear from you. And there is an address, an email address that you can write and get more information from, if you'd like to, through the Oak Advocacy Network. And the email is www.oakmn.org. So that's www.oakmn.org. And they have some processes that you can use to either contact your legislators by, or contact Governor Dayton or the legislators through email. Or you can contact them and you can post messages on Facebook just to spread the word. We really want to make sure that this legislation actually gets signed into law. And it's going to take a lot of pressure from the grassroots up. If you have friends that live in North Minneapolis area where school choice, I think, would be even more beneficial, try to get in touch with your friends there and ask them to reach out to Governor Dayton to make sure that this becomes law.
Right. I mean, there's been such a swing in the legislature for the state of Minnesota. You know, our hope is that he's going to go ahead and do the will of the people who elected the legislature that's in place right
yes,
now.
Yes, exactly right. You know, it's interesting because our federal government was in that position for a while, too, with President Obama being president and then both the House and Senate being Republican there for a while. And
which they are right now with a Republican president.
I know. We're still not seeing a lot of benefit from that, are we? From if you're a conservative out there and you were hoping to see some legislation.
What's really
going
on?
We're not seeing a lot. Right, exactly. We're seeing a lot of uproar.
More friction.
Kind of like a, what do they say, a bull in the china shop? Is that what it is? That's more what it's like, isn't it, right now? But that to say, this would be very beneficial legislation. And so I encourage our listeners to get involved in this, because if we stay quiet, if good people do nothing, then we can't complain when we don't see things change, right?
That's right.
So good people out there, pay attention and please take the time to reach out to Governor Dayton
only
and ask him to sign this into law, because it will benefit so many kids across the state of Minnesota. That's for sure. Well, we are going to wind up this show, and we're going to do one more show related to the Blaine Amendment next week. And we're going to be talking more about the court cases that have come out of across the country, not just here in Minnesota, but across the country. Right, Mark?
It's interesting. In fact, the wording of these Blaine Amendments in different states has brought about quite a division, even from SCOTUS all the way down to the lower courts, and we're going to talk about that a little bit next week.
All right. It's going to be an interesting show. So once again, if you would like to listen to this show or any of our past shows, go to Education Nation on Facebook, and you can find our podcast, or you can listen to the podcast on KLBB, and we look forward to having you join us again next week.